August 12th, 1979, I'm talking with Harold Doc Ewan at his home in Weston, Massachusetts on early years of 21 centimeter line. But before we get into that, can you please tell me what your educational background was and how it was that you first came into contact with astronomy and what came to be known as radio astronomy?
Well, I started Tech High 39 in Springfield, went on to American International College as a freshman. After deciding not to go to Springfield College and become a Messel man. Then I went to my sophomore year to Amherst. Actually, I was on my way up to UMass and thought I was at UMass when I stopped at Amherst and went in and tried their swimming pool. And it turned out at the time that I was swimming with the son of one of the professors in astronomy at Amherst, and he suggested that there was a short walk from the swimming pool to the dean's office, and we became close friends immediately. And the dean then asked me that typical question, why do you want to come to Amherst? And I told him that I wanted to teach at Amherst, and I thought that anyone that was a teacher at Amherst should be also a graduate of Amherst. And he said he hadn't heard that one before. And based on that answer, he offered me a full tuition scholarship at Amherst. And so I entered as a sophomore. And that went on through the junior year until the war broke out. And at that time, I elected to accelerate my program in the summer of 42 and to graduate then in January of 43. But also at that time, pressures were put on the faculty at Amherst to call them to essentially analytical duty at MIT in the Rad Lab, and they lost one of their professors, John Hall, who later became the senior observer at Kitt Peak, or director at Kitt Peak. But John Hall was at that time at Amherst, and when he left in a search to find someone in the field of astronomy, they located me as a senior. And I, at that time, just prior, a couple of months, had decided also to major in astronomy. So I was offered the opportunity then in my senior year to teach astronomy as a member of the faculty, and also then finish up.
So you fulfilled
January.
Your wish earlier than you might have thought about teaching at Amherst.
It was done very cleverly by President King, who called me into his office one day in the spring of 42, just finishing the junior year. And reminded me of that answer that I'd given the dean. Right. And he said, I've got the note here, and I've also got the recommendation that you be placed on the faculty as a senior. So here's your chance. So that's how I joined the faculty. One of the problems, of course, was at the commencement, would I walk in with the faculty or the class? And I guess the record that was set was the youngest member of the faculty in the 122 years of the college at the time. But that was my history at Amherst, and then I stayed on at Amherst for 1 year as an assistant director of the V5 training program. And that was important for the occasion primarily of working with a director who was the head of the astronomy department, Warren Green. Mm-hmm. Warren Green and I then became very close friends during that year while we were handling the V5 program. But it was historical also from the standpoint that the Navy sent their baseball cadets to Amherst. And so I had his students for about 6 to 8 months, Ted Williams and Johnny Pesky and Johnny Sane, and I got to know them pretty well. And every time I'd give Ted a tough time on an exam, he'd take me down the ball cage and explain to me that he knew how to pitch as well. If I just stand there at the plate, he would throw a few over and see if I could drive him up into the net. So I've been a good buddy of Ted's for some while, and it was handy later because many of my scientific friends are also friends of the baseball scene. And I recall on one occasion when Bob Oppenheimer dropped into the lab at Harvard, and we all came to attention, shuddering graduate students. He said, I've got a question for you guys. Where's Fenway Park? So that was the sort of thing that was very good there. Now, from there, we go from Amherst then into World War II with the Navy, training in radar, electronics, Princeton, MIT, then off to air training in Florida and Chincoteague, Virginia, and ultimately to patrol bombing squadron 112, which was at that time located in England. It had moved up from Africa. And so during that period, while I was with the patrol bombing squadron, my assignment as a radar officer flying with the squadron was to fly with the 18 aircraft patrolling the English Channel. And so we spent a fair amount of time off the Netherlands and France and Germany, looking for submarines at fairly low altitude in Liberator-type aircraft. But it was coincidentally at about the same time that Vanderhulst was giving his presentation in the Netherlands on the 21-centimeter line and also the foundation of all of the lines that would be forthcoming in the historical development of radio astronomy.
So you were, by the end of the war, then very familiar with radar and technically and operationally.
Right. I came back from the Navy, the last post in Washington, to Harvard to enter as a enter the graduate school for a doctorate in physics, which I'd selected primarily because of the interest in the atomic bomb as a benefactor of my being able to return from anywhere, since I was presumably to go from Whidbey Island to Attu, and it had been explained to all naval air types that the weather conditions in Attu were such that you took off and you had a choice of landing in Russia or China after you bombed northern Japan. But it was a one flight per shot, and you had trained for 2 months for your one flight. And it was in that period that we heard about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it changed my thinking about my future education, other than finding out what these fellows had uncorked back at the labs in Cambridge. And so I then did apply while I was at, as a matter of fact, with the Office of Research and Inventions, which became ONR. Mm-hmm. I had selected a position there as a personnel officer, of officer personnel, just relocating officers here and there, rather than work as a so-called electronics expert for a patent attorney. And when the time came for filling out applications for the future, Professor Warren Green, again from Amherst, who was quite disgusted with my interest in business and law and things like that that I chatted with him about, sent me an application for an NRC fellowship in physics, because I told him I was now interested in physics but not astronomy. And so he sent me the application, I filled it out, sent it in, and that upset ONR a bit, because their physics department, astronomy department, naval research, there was only one NRC fellow, and he happened to be in administration that year. So with my NRC fellowship under my arm, I went off to Harvard to study physics.
This is 46?
This is in 46, in the fall of 46. And the initial time at Harvard was spent getting the necessary courses out of the way. My problem primarily was that I was short in the study of physics. And I had not had a good background preparation, classical physics, because my work at Amherst had been predominantly mathematics and then briefly astronomy, and only then the application of mathematics to astronomy.
Right.
So fellows like Newton and so forth were not that well known to me. And it became an interesting game at Harvard during those early years, 46, 48, that I found it easier to understand relativistic theory, quantum mechanics, than understand how I could make n larger and agree with those fellows that like to bounce apples off heads. So I became known fairly shortly as the quantum baby. Can you take a fellow right out of the womb, put him into a graduate school, teach him relativity, and he'll say, what else is there? And it was just so natural and so easy, but I would occasionally stumble given a problem in classical physics. I had very little difficulty with the quantum mechanics and the standard Clermont and so on. So at about that time, and during that period, I, because of the Navy policy, was retained as a naval officer on inactive duty. But I'd jump into my blue suit, run down to Squantum Naval Air Base, or meet with the Harvard group, as it was called, of reserve officers every couple of weeks. And our CO at the time was Donald Menzel, who, during the war, was a four-striper, and after the war was elevated to rear admiral. So the problem then was how we could do something productive that would relate to Menzel's interest in the sun, our interest in whatever we were doing in the graduate schools in the local area, Harvard and MIT. And I came up with the thought of a possibility of building a solar radio telescope, since that seemed to be in Menzel's areas of interest, and it happened to be something that I didn't think would be all that difficult from what I'd heard concerning solar signals.
Now, where had you heard about this?
I'd heard about the detection through Menzel when he gave a talk at the reserve officers meeting.
Okay.
And by then, in preparation for this, Menzel seemed mildly interested, and he said, well, what do you really know about the field of radio astronomy? It's come a fairly long way, and familiar with Grote Reber and all that. I didn't know anything. So he said, well, why don't you spend your 2 weeks of active duty down at the Stirling Labs with Grote Reber, and I'll make the arrangement. So Don Menzel made the arrangement for me to go down and spend a couple of weeks with Grote Reber, which were very productive in understanding how far to stop a model, can't recall what model type car I had at that time. It wasn't the Model A I had at Amherst. But Reber was quite concerned about ignition noise and things like that, and it became quite a buzzword in the whole field. So you usually walked into Reber's camp from quite a distance. And so I spent a couple of weeks with Grote Reber and became somewhat fascinated with what he was doing. He's not a strong conversationalist.
No. What were your impressions of him at that time? Can you remember?
My impression was that he seemed to be either considered me as though a graduate student. I think it did help a little in his opinion of me that I ultimately made arrangements for the Navy to wear civilian clothes rather than the uniform. The uniform he found very appalling. And he would not talk to me, and he just said, that's stupid, take that off. So I finally prevailed upon the Navy, and they said, yes, if you're working up there in the woods with Grote Reber, that's fine. And then he would talk to me a little, but I had the impression that he was racing against time. He seemed to be overwhelmed with the important task to be done, which only he alone understood. And he was not in a position to describe in detail what the plan would be, even for the two-week period, other than follow me around, pick up that screwdriver, hold this meter, do that. And I felt like a real gopher running around with Grote and trying to catch on to what was going on in his mind and why he seemed so desperately anxious to use every minute. He was always there bright and early in the morning, worked late, forget about meals. He was just around the clock. Not a gadgeteer at all, just a fellow trying to get a job done. It was a very, very motivating experience. And we did, I think we became friends to the degree of, at the time of parting, of sort of going to a summer camp, you know, sort of a mild respect, not knowing each other well enough, but understanding the space that surrounded both of us.
Right.
And I recall his saying goodbye, and I had to come up and say him in my uniform, because I was leaving to go back to good old Boston, and he said, well, you try to get out of that just as soon as you can. And at least he talked to me for the first time in the uniform.
What was he doing scientifically at that time?
It was primarily at that time, as I recall, it was solar, though I talked to him about a year ago. And he said what he was doing at that time was trying to get a better feeling for the improvement in receiver technology. Pardon, and he had a raft of Wurzburg antennas there.
Right.
And there were certain obvious things that he felt could be done, and he hadn't discussed them in detail with the Bureau. And as a matter of fact, it was about that time, I think it was within a week or two after I left, to give you a feel for what was on his mind, that he disappeared. And they tried to send him the famous check that came back, and then found he'd gone to Maui. He showed up at Maui.
Oh, no, I haven't heard the famous check story.
Oh, he just didn't show up.
Right.
And no one knew where he was.
Yeah.
And the checks came back, you know, that...
his paychecks.
Paychecks, just coming back to the Bureau. Where is he? And so it got to be, has anyone seen Grote Reber? And then about 6-7 months later, said, somebody saw him in a bucket of bamboo on top of Maui. Maui. And then he disappeared from Maui and showed up in Tasmania. So he has these moments.
Right.
And I happened then to see him at the Bureau just prior to his sort of eruption on his way to Maui.
Yeah.
And as I say, he's just... I don't feel he's really changed all that much.
Oh, no, he hasn't, no.
From just in the last year when I saw him. He's exciting fellow.
Exactly.
There we go. And
still very, very eccentric. That's why I was interested in your reaction. But now, at that time... Well, hold it now. We're talking about 48, 9?
We're year? Talking about 47, maybe... About in there. See, I was right in the reserve. I got out of the reserve in 48, I believe.
Are you getting mixed up with another visit to him as far as him taking off? I think he stayed at NBS for a few more years. He went to Maui until 51 or 2.
He went before I left Harvard, I know that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he left.
No, that's true.
And I wasn't really in that close touch with him. I guess it's probably a little difficult when you're a grad student, because I wasn't in that close a touch with radio astronomy.
But in any case, what I was going to ask is that he had an interest in detecting the 21-centimeter line.
In fact, he's got
pictures of the equipment that he was putting together in the late 40s.
His comment on that, as a matter of fact, last year was that he took a look at it. He was going to try for it, but he was pretty sure it was going to be so difficult from a radio standpoint that it probably wasn't worth it.
But did you talk with him at that time at all?
No, not about 21.
No.
Because it hadn't entered my life at that time, and his interest, as I recall, was primarily solar and the galactic, of course, in his mappings.
Yeah,
but we didn't talk about any line work.
So anyway, and then to
put it in context, during all of that period, I would say right up until 49, my interest in radio astronomy was. Equivalent, or generated, or motivated, by the requirement that I report to the Navy one night a week every 2 weeks. So one night a week, every 2 weeks, I would get interested in radio astronomy with my rear admiral. And we'd talk about the sun and the good things, and then I'd disappear for 2 weeks and go back and do something important, like nuclear physics.
And this went on for how long?
Oh, this went on until 49. In 48, I decided to take a position at the nuclear lab, and went down to the NSF, Chatham Falls at NRC, because you're not supposed to work while you're graduate student. So we negotiated, and I elected to give back the fellowship and proceed to work at the nuclear lab.
What is the official name of this lab?
It was called Nuclear Cyclotron Lab. We put out a book in...
So this was a 50-inch...
95-inch...
95-inch cyclotron was being built at Harvard at this time.
Right, and we completed it in 49 and wrote it up in 1950, and then actually went to work in experimentally, carrying out experiments such as... my part of it was to obtain an external beam. The other contribution I made was details on frequency modulation of the cyclotron itself, moving the capacitive variable portion of the circuit outside of the magnetic field. Well, during that period, I had completed a master's work, I'd completed all of my coursework, and I'd become quite fascinated with the field of nuclear physics and this great gadget, the cyclotron. And it was time then to seriously think about a doctor thesis. Of all of the teachers that I'd encountered, the one I found most fascinating was Ed Purcell. And that was through a course in electron ballistics.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had just a slight feeling for electronics from the Navy. Crash program of 90 days at MIT is good, but it's not an EE degree. And to then go through the experience with Purcell, of taking a ride on an electron through a magnetic field and discovering that you're dealing with just about any type of device in a very simple way. It was such a pleasure,
very much
like his current book, where you take a relativistic ride.
Right.
And so I felt a sort of a companionship or sincere interest in his way of looking at things. So I then selected him as a thesis advisor without a thesis, and we agreed to sit down and think about thesis subjects. And my suggestion package was that it would be helpful to me if I could take the various areas of application focus them in one direction. It was the radar work I'd done, the astronomy, the math, because Ed asked, well, what are you proficient at? And I said, I just had a smattering of a number of mountains, and I feel pretty comfortable in the valleys. And I noticed that there are a lot of fellas on one mountain that don't talk to others.
Right.
And if I could just play in that game, I said, in just working with a group in the Naval Reserve and Menzel's group, that by the time I knew a little bit more about quantum mechanics and related some of that to what was going on in the observational data, I could see the dichotomy of the radio astronomer from the astronomy end of it and the electronic engineer, and that they weren't really talking on the same wavelength. Mm-hmm. And I thought that perhaps there was a place in the valley to bring all of this together.
Right.
And that I thought a very interesting one would be to do a bang-up job on the water vapor line, because I'd also, by the way, taught meteorology while I was at Amherst. And I had taken, while I was at Harvard had a requirement in the physics department that you become, in effect, a master of four subjects. That's one of their physics department requirements, and that you could satisfy two of the subjects by courses, A, B, whatever. You could satisfy a third, more examination at a master's level, and the fourth would be your doctor field.
Mm-hmm.
And I approached that requirement with some amazement that I didn't realize there were four separate fields of physics that you could get involved in. Apparently Harvard had that approach to it. And so I picked math, which was accepted, and politics, and then elected to take meteorology as a third subject. And I required the permission then of my thesis advisor, and I talked to Ed about it. And he said, that's a pseudoscience. It's not a science. We don't even teach it here. I said, well, I teach it down at MIT. And I've been taking the courses down there. And I haven't decided yet, but I'm so close to completing all courses in meteorology at MIT that I may elect to take a doctorate in meteorology. And I think it's sort of a science, if we can separate the various parts of meteorology, the understanding of circulations, things like that, or certainly physics of some sort.
Right.
That was before aerodynamics was a popular thing. And Harvard at the time had the Blue Hills Observatory and Professor Brooks, and that was Harvard's total part of the program. That's contribution to meteorology.
So you were actually thinking of getting a doctorate in meteorology?
I didn't know what I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I just,
but that was a distinct possibility.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I taught meteorology, as I say, at Amherst, and that was after staying one chapter ahead of the students, and so I thought it'd be nice to really know a little more about it. And so I did then, during that period, take the courses at MIT during 47, 8, and so on, for a doctorate. And so then my oral was in meteorology.
What were you thinking about doing with the water vapor line?
Well, my interest there was really to get a better feeling for the variability in water vapor, since what Dickey had done was to, I felt, demonstrate a technique,
right,
but did not have the opportunity to melt the science that might be there.
Didn't get much information on the atmosphere.
No, true.
Right.
And with the meteorology and with this electronic technique, it seemed to marry a few disciplines, and it also married Dickey to Purcell, which I found interesting when I first looked up Dickey's paper and found Purcell's OK signature on it. So I said, well, that's for me. That helped a little in focusing my attention on the water line at 22. So I suggested that to Purcell. And he didn't seem to be too enthusiastic about the idea. So it would just be another point on the curve that had been done. It could be done. He wasn't refusing me the opportunity, but that it might take a considerable amount of time to do the line structure in adequate detail to represent a useful thesis. Right. And it was a couple of weeks later, when we're still thrashing around looking for a program, I was over at his house, and he said, I know you're interested in that Dickey thing, but it occurs to me that there's a follow-up. Oh, fine, thank you. I think we're we're going to have to
thank you.
Throw this thing off here as lunch arrives.
why don't you just finish this story?
He says, a fellow, he said, I think he's Dutch, I'm not sure. But I saw a paper the other day, an abstract paper, where a fellow apparently has come up with a prediction that you can measure the hydrogen hyperfine line.
And in the interstellar.
In interstellar space.
Right.
And he said, you ought to look into that. And I said, no, what? He's from where? He said, well, he's a Dutchman, I think. And I saw it somewhere. He said, I read so many doggone things come across my desk. But he said, I thought of you when I saw it, because that's got to be a lot better than doing a water line in the atmosphere. And I said, well, what's the probability that it can be detected? And why doesn't he do it? Why doesn't this Dutchman do it? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, those are things for you to look into. And he said, but I'll tell you, if you could get a gas line in interstellar space, anything like that, not the atmosphere, but if you could get that, he said, you'd get your face in Life magazine and no one would ever forget you. And he said, that would be a real great point in the curve. And he said, and if you don't, you've only wasted a couple of years of your life. And he said, you're the kind of guy that likes to do different things. Why don't you do this thing? Give it a whirl.
And
that was his pitch. You know, what are you going to lose? A couple of years?
Right. Well, now, what year would this be? When
this was, I would say, fall of 49.
Okay. Well, let's take a break.
Now
so, continuing after lunch now.
So, having heard this, apparently you had some interest, and then... How did you perceive the problem?
I did the typical quotes literature search.
Right.
Located a copy of Vanderhoof's paper and arranged to have it transcribed by Purcell's wife, Bess, who was studying Japanese at the time and Russian, and she will transcribe anything.
Translate.
Excuse me. And... So we had that in hand. We also, then as part of the so-called literature search, I began going around to the various club meetings of the astronomers, American Astronomical Society, and whatever. And also discovered that Commission 5 of IRSI was far more popular from a radio astronomer standpoint, because in the astronomy field, the optical astronomers considered radio astronomers essentially the second-class citizen. And Commission 5 of IRSI was the only receptive international or even national audience. It wasn't that it was international, it was at all important.
Right.
There just was no place for radio astronomers to go to publish and discuss things.
So you were going to IRSI meetings while you were doing your thesis work? I mean,
this was
before 51?
This was in early 49. This was shortly after finishing off the oral and meteorology and the core studies and so forth, looking into this essentially under the direction of Purcell to find out more about this Dutch paper and also about the field.
Yeah.
And just get a feeling.
Right. But what I'm getting at, though, is that you did get into this before 1951. It wasn't just
in
51 that you began finding out about American astronomers.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'd done quite a bit of reading, and I'd become familiar with Reaver's work and
NRL's work, probably.
Right, absolutely.
Now, did you get any useful advice in these couple years before 51 about radiometers astronomy, as far as that goes?
None at all. As a matter of fact, I was pretty much alone as far as the radio astronomy part of it, because there was no activity at Harvard in that area, nor at MIT, to my knowledge. And so I would depart from this community of Cambridge scholars, so-called, and then go off to these meetings and come back with there are people out there working in this field type thing. And so I'd make any close allies or friends in the field at these meetings, because they're relatively short. And though I did get, on one occasion, to chat with John Hagen, who's an Austin guy, who was at NRL at the time. And I recall leaning over at some meeting, I was down at Yale, at a Commission 5, IRSI, and I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, I'm Doc Ewan and I'm from Harvard. And I was wondering whether when you're speaking later this afternoon, could you talk about this 21-centimeter line that's been suggested by Vanderhoof? Because I'm going to be detecting it for my doctorate thesis. And he turned around with a look on his face, like, go home, you don't even belong to the Radio Astronomy Club. And just sort of, well, that's very interesting, yeah. but we do have other things on the right. schedule this afternoon. And so that just went down the drain. And so I went back home. I thought that was a loss to get to know all these fellas. And I, of course, most of the publications were in Australia or
England. Yeah. And of course, they were interested in the sun. They were interested in the sun also.
Mm-hmm. Strictly. So from that, I then went back, chatted with Ed Purcell about carrying out this experiment. And my feeling was that in reviewing the literature, that the Russians really were likely to detect it long before we could get the equipment together. And that was based on Shklovsky's paper.
His 48 paper, yeah.
Right, which was so close on to the time I became involved in looking mm-hmm. into things. And it was about the time I'd read Vanderhoof, I'd read Shklovsky, and I talked with what few in the U.S. area were doing anything in radio astronomy, and it seemed to be, one, a difficult experiment, a very risky doctorate-type thing, since that was considerable question as to what mechanism we might be dealing with here, or whether there's anything we'd be dealing with. And so Purcell then sort of summed it up, since he couldn't really justify it logically. You go to the blackboard and say, well, here's what we're... He justified doing it very simply by saying, you know, if you can do it, then you'll be in Life magazine, you'll never be forgotten. And if you don't do it, it's only going to cost you a couple of years of your life. And I said, fine, I'll... on that basis, since we understand each other, I'll go back and get a better job at the nuclear lab for the long pull, and we'll continue to look into this in sort of a hobby way in the interim. Why don't I take a little harder look at what we know about the hyperfine line, because it would be awfully nice to know what frequency very precisely right. I should build this device on. And that wasn't a very simple thing to come by in those days. Well, in any event.
Well, in fact, the frequency you were using was measured by Kusch and Purcell,
right.
I believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kusch in Columbia, and that was the one we used.
Right, but was that experiment done because of your need for a precise frequency, or did it just happen that it was done at the same
just
time?
Just happened. It also just happened coincidentally that Mumford came up with the gas discharge noise source as a method for measuring noise figure of microwave receivers
mm-hmm.
just at that time. And that's why I built a gas discharge noise source to calibrate. What we were interested in was if Ed and I agreed was if we're going to do it, let's do it very right.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the care to make sure it was done right was jointly shared, because both of us, though very optimistic when we met, were a bit pessimistic, I guess, when we were alone. And we want to make sure when you're going to come up with a negative thesis, it's very important that you, for example, have an antenna you know a lot about.
Right.
So you think about a horn antenna.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple, and it's well described in the Rad Lab series. So though it would have been easier and quicker to throw together a parabola, feet of focus, a little slot-fed British dipole, that was rejected immediately by both of us. I was really quite pleased in the discussions I had with Ed, that when I'd say, well, why don't we do this, or he'd make a similar suggestion, we'd both agree, and invariably it was related to making absolutely sure that when we said it hadn't been detected, that we knew how far we'd gone,
mm-hmm.
and how precisely, how much more difficult the task to go beyond the point.
Whereas we would say now, you wanted to make sure you knew what your brightness temperature limit
Absolutely.
Was,
right.
and not with no ground
contribution. We want to be able to say, this transition is not detectable in interstellar space
right.
Below this level.
Were you worried about interference?
No, not at all.
Of course, at those sort of frequencies in those days, I guess it wasn't
right,
too bad.
Wasn't, it was very, 1420 was a very high frequency
yeah.
in those days.
Yeah.
Though X-band was around, things like that, and radar, there wasn't that much activity going on. So we agreed to proceed, and that agreement was put in effect in the spring of 49. And decisions then about method were the points of the discussions we had. And I think all of the basic decisions were made at one meeting early on, that it would be a horn, that calibration would be by a gas discharge noise source, that the mixer would be a scaled waveguide mixer, based on a drawing in the Radlab series that had been drawn and placed there by Bob Pound, who was right next door to Purcell. So if I couldn't quite understand how you scale that drawing, I can ask Bob. And that we would use a 21 crystal, which was a pet also of Bell Laboratories. And coincidentally, the crystals were provided by Fries at home.
From Bell, yeah.
At a meeting I had down there to drop in at Bell and make sure that I hadn't overlooked anything in microwaves and putting this receiver together. So the care was just to make sure that we're doing the very best in the state of the art. Calibration was appropriate. And I recall in that afternoon and being ushered finally into Fries's office, just prior to leaving to go back to Boston, that he reached down in the drawer in his desk and he said, "I've been waiting for an occasion like this to give some kid the very best crystals I've ever seen. A 120, these are beautiful." So I got two of the best crystals that Bell Lab directed seen. So I put me on my way back to Boston. And then the cascode circuit for the preamplifier was a critical item. And I then contacted Bill Pritchard, who was the radar division manager for Raytheon in Wayland at the time, to determine the status of cascode or better preamplifiers developed by Raytheon in their radar effort during the war. And he provided me considerable insight on the cascode amplifier, plus some very nice tubes and the latest circuit designs. And Bill, since that time, then went on to become director of ComSat and so on, so we've kept in close touch over the years, but that's how I first met him, was looking into the preamp game through Raytheon. That's why it's mentioned in the thesis. So that put all the parts together. And from there on in, it was just a matter of gathering together the test equipment and assembling it.
Were these components, these low-noise components, as you look back on it, were they essential in detecting a line, or did they just give you much better signal noise? And
they weren't. The parts that were actually fabricated, designed and fabricated, were all of the way, well, the horn, all of the waveguide through the mixer. Which included a slotted line prior to the mixer, the gas discharge noise source in full L-band guide, and all of this to be absolutely sure, certain of the calibration more than anything else. For detection, no. I would think, for example, today you can detect 21 centimeters with a pack of cigarettes and a paperclip. So, but there's nothing was.
But you could have then also.
In hindsight.
But of course you didn't know.
But
you didn't know.
I think I would have been a little reticent, though, for example, to have placed a number on the brightness temperature to the degree I was happy enough to do it then. We were dealing with new techniques at the time, but certainly just the idea of what we mean by a beam efficiency of a Fivet focus parabola is still pretty much out to lunch with most electrical engineers.
It's not a standard concept.
Right, they don't think in that term. And and I've encountered numerous problems in that area, just currently. That is still not put together, put to bed correctly. And so, in any event. I think in answer to your question, we took the care to put something together so that, in the words of Purcell, faced with a wet rock, we'd make it as dry as possible. And so we're down there, you know, we've got to say this cannot be detected. So that was the care. Now, second, you have to sort of keep in mind that it hadn't been detected, its presence was very suspect, whether or not speculative. And even when we did detect it, jumping a little ahead in the story, there was a considerable analytical flap over what we detected. Mm-hmm. We detected hydrogen, and we knew it detected hydrofine line, but just why it was there and why it had that intensity, yeah, got to be quite a bit of discussion.
Right, right. And that, Ed Purcell told me about some of those questions. But let's go back though still. I mean, another critical aspect was the whole business of what bandwidth to use, what kind of switching to use. Can you tell me about those decisions? Right.
Those decisions, with regard to bandwidth, the thought was that the minimum bandwidth should be somewhere around 5 kilohertz. And this was selected on the basis of considering what spreading there might be because of the beam, the antenna beam. Not much thought, though, really, about a fully thought-out analysis of what we were going to face with the motion of the Earth and the solar system. That came much later as a surprise.
I see.
So, originally it was somewhere in the 5 to 20 kilohertz bandwidth would be adequate. Certainly not less than 5. Second, and this is in part influenced by the fact that for a typical AM receiver, 4 or 5 kilohertz is a reasonably easy bandwidth, and 20 or 30 gets to be pretty hard to come by unless you're going to modify the receiver. And I had already decided that all of the processing part, the IF strip, would be an off-the-shelf communications receiver. Or you could plug in variable bandwidths and do all that sort of thing. Why discover radio again? So that's why the construction, the design construction, ended with the Casco preamps. Then the idea was a second convert, use a 30 megahertz communications receiver, and from there on in, use the communications receiver. So, first, switch frequency. Not knowing exactly how wide the line would be, the very first thing I tried was to take a motor, an electric motor with a generator coupled to it, with a lucite disc that had been coated, half of it metallically, and spin it near the tank circuit of the LO so that I would get a 30 hertz frequency shift, sine wave. And I managed to get a pulling using the standard national radio, which was located locally in Medford, so if I had any problems with my IF strip, I'd just hop in the car and go over to Medford and say, these are the things I want to do. And so I mounted that up and I used the generator for my reference to feed the synchronous detector. And it was a very simple way then to drive the motor and drive the disc, and noted that the frequency shift was about 10 kilohertz and no line, because we're inside the line. So the next thing was to...
switching at a rate of 30 hertz.
30 hertz.
10 kilohertz away.
Right. 10 kilohertz was all I could get, moving a disc up near the tank circuit without completely loading the circuit.
Did you sit down and think once again about motions in the galaxy and or turbulence and say, no, how much should I need? So you were just going to try to move out until you could maybe get it.
Oh, the first thing was... I was looking at it more... First, the physicist part of my mountain was saying to the valley, let's get the frequency right. And let's admit that the line width is going to be pretty much unknown, and it's going to be about as gobbledygook as the optical lines. So or some of the infrared stuff that's come down the pipe. So let's just stay loose on that part of it, not make that a buried in concrete part of the design. The electrical engineer was saying, let's do the best up front as far as getting an antenna that most people will understand, build it in waveguide, design a mixer that was homegrown at Harvard while at Radlab, Bob Pound, use a Casco preamp grown over in Raytheon, and design and build this as carefully as possible, hook it up with a communication set that comes from Medford, National Radio, and then proceed to fiddle with things like bandwidth and switching rates at a level of convenience, so that at least you don't, I knew if I switched, say, 10 megahertz, it'd probably work. but I probably wouldn't get the job done before 1960. So it was, let's not do anything on the tail end that would embarrass us later.
Yeah.
It's like, why did it take so long?
But and now when you say you did not detect the line with switching away 5 kilohertz or 10 kilohertz, did you tune the LO through a broad range before you made that decision?
Right. The LO was tuned over a range of plus or minus 150.